Our waters have acted as the largest food bank since the beginning of time. In areas across the world and even in your own backyard, you still have the ability to fish for your dinner. Let's align protection with production. Let's find more modern ways of looking at this, and let's recognize how important they are so that we can have a responsible blue food system in the future.
Hello, and welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. I'm Dr. Linda Ulrich, the host of the podcast and also the co-founder of the Goodness Exchange. The Goodness Exchange is this amazing landscape of news and articles and recordings and videos of folks in our world who are making the future better for all of us, but the news media can't take any time to share the message of their incredible ideas with us. So we're doing it here and at the Goodness Exchange, and every week you can join us to hear from some amazing innovator like the amazing woman we have today, and we will take you on a little journey that puts a spring in your step again. So today our guest is Jennifer Bushman. She is a leading expert in elevating our understanding of the sustainable world of aquaculture, essentially farming in water. That's something that I really didn't appreciate much till I heard Jennifer speak at an innovation event. Whether we're talking about the sea or freshwater lakes, ponds, and rivers, it turns out there's this whole world of ingenious people and solutions that we consumers are not hearing enough about. So get ready to be delighted and hungry. What's new is that water farming has now the potential to provide abundant seafood and foods from freshwater all over the world. Jennifer is also the co-founder of an organization called Fed by Blue, and she's the executive producer for an upcoming docuseries called Hope in the Water, set to air on PBS on June 19th, 2024. So we're going to get a delightful preview of that docuseries too. And after listening to this episode, you'll be on the cutting edge of a whole new landscape of choices when you go to the grocery store. And this is a consumer shift that you will be anxious to participate in. So welcome, Jennifer Bushman.
Thank you so much for having me, Linda. It's great to be here and to talk about one of the topics that's so close to my heart, which is blue foods. People sometimes think it's blueberries, but it's really blue of the water, the beautiful foods that we have been eating for since the beginning of time and that feed nearly 3.2 billion people on the planet every day.
Oh my gosh. You know, I mentioned you're speaking at this innovation event called Sea Change that my co-founder and I, my daughter and I attended. And I tell you, she is one of these savvy, millennial, hard to impress folks, a Harvard grad, even more hard to impress. And after you got done, she turned to me and she said, "Mom, I would follow that woman over a cliff."
I love her so much, and I appreciate that. It's easy when you're really passionate about something and when you know that it's something that's extremely important for us all to understand.
Yeah, it's really, really something, your message. So let's get right to it. So here's where I was at until I listened to your talk. I don't know what the heck to do when I go to a seafood restaurant. We live in a little Vermont town near Montreal, and we go every Thursday there. It's your typical nice restaurant where everybody knows your name and they know your drink and they bring it to your table before you can get there. And it is a seafood restaurant. And do you know, every Thursday night for God knows how many years, 20 years, I don't order seafood there.
Wow.
Yeah, because I just don't know. Should I eat the this or not eat the that? And when my husband ordered swordfish, I think, God, how many swordfish are there left in the world? You know? So what I'm hoping we can all get out of today's episode is this freedom and some joy about accessing this whole world that you know so much about. So I just can't thank you for joining us.
Well, it is overwhelming. I mean, when we go to the grocery store or we go to a restaurant, chicken is pretty easy to figure out. It's just a chicken. It's one of the top proteins that's consumed in the United States. It's either natural or it's organic or it's commodity, but it's still just chicken. And when you think about beef now, we've had lots of conversations about our animal rearing on land and grass-fed beef and coming from a ranch that you know that's local, or maybe even someplace that you, a farmer that you meet at the farmer's market, and you just support them. There's comfort in that. But on the water, there are hundreds of species. In fact, both for freshwater as well as marine-based, there are over 2,500 species of consumable things, whether it's the algaes, the vegetables, those delicious seaweeds and kelps, or the fish and seafood. So it's no wonder why you're confused. But it's the same as when you sort of put your lens on things that you're buying from land. Those same ideas apply to water. And so with a few questions and a little bit of information, you can eat seafood comfortably and you can know and understand where your fish and seafood is coming from.
Okay. And that is the crux of the problem. I remember, and I'm sure people have their own stories about this. I remember ages ago, probably, and I've been acting on this for at least two decades. I remember ages ago when PCBs were first something that was showing up, I remember seeing or reading some news story that seemed very credible because I've always been like a credibility nerd about shrimp, not buying shrimp at the grocery store because it was probably raised in pools in Southeast Asia that were full of all kinds of weird chemicals. And that's it. That scared me off shrimp and everything else. So why don't you start at the top and have us give us an appreciation for maybe a couple of the myths right off, and then we can go deeper into some of those later too.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just as you can farm a shrimp well, you could farm a shrimp badly. Just as you can farm a chicken well, you can farm a chicken badly. So yes, is it ever a good idea to buy something where you don't know the provenance and the background of where it comes from? So you weren't wrong. But there has been a narrative, and it's been perpetuated by a number of NGOs and leaders that you can't rear a seafood well. And the truth is, you actually can. And we've been doing that for thousands of years. Aquaculture has been around for thousands of years. We've been raising fish and seafood. The fish pond system in Hawaii is 1,200 years old. So it is possible. It's just you have to have the provenance and know where that food comes from. So, for example, in the docuseries, we interview a shrimp farmer that's farming shrimp on his dairy in the middle of Minnesota. And he's raising it at the highest level and selling it to grocery stores all throughout Minnesota.
Wow. And there's probably dozens, if not hundreds, of variations on that same sort of innovative mindset. What does it take to raise this here?
And also wild. So, I mean, the reality is this is going to be a complicated puzzle to put together our food system. And we're going to need to do better with our land resources. We're going to do better with the water. I mean, the planet is 71% water. We're not going to just leave it alone in service to our food system. We're going to have to align water protection with water production in service to our food system. So we'll have wild captured shrimp, I hope, from the Gulf of Mexico. And you might sit down and say, oh my gosh, this is this wonderful shrimp that I love when it's in season. And then hopefully you'll encourage the restaurant that you go to every Thursday night to mark on the menu who the farmer is so that you can get the shrimp that you want from the farm you love.
And you know, this is a fundamental concept. You know, I'm in Vermont where we're all kind of hippy-dippy about stuff like this. And every single restaurant has locally raised this or locally sourced that. And you talk to us a lot about that locally sourced thing and that supporting local farmers. And you're not just talking about dirt farmers or dairy farmers. Talk to us about this, keeping it local and this helping us update our notions about local and wild caught and all that.
Well, I mean, the reality is the fish and seafood industry is a global industry. You know, we have been moving fish and seafood all over the world for a long time. In fact, fish and seafood changes hands more than any other ingredient in our food and beverage supply chain, on average 9 to 10 times. So that poke bowl that you love so much, that's that yellowfin tuna, the odds are it's coming from Indonesia. And those waters, we know that there are a lot of poor practices, all the way from bad fishing practices, bad gear practices, to practices of slavery, frankly, in the supply chain where the fishermen are so badly treated. But there are fisheries where you can trace it, like through fair trade seafood, where you can trace that all the way to the family and the small boats that are two family members that are fishing that fish. So again, it's no different than a commodity corn to an organic corn. You still can have fish and seafood from a global supply chain, but you have to know where it comes from. You are in a rare environment where you have a lot of local seafood that's coming in to the state of Vermont, but someone in Indiana may not have that same privilege. And then that is even more important to ask a couple of questions. Don't go up to the seafood counter or the menu blindly. Ask where the seafood comes from. Tell me where you get it from. Have them go look on the box. What's the species? What's the country of origin? Start a conversation, because you want to encourage those groups to start to know where their seafood comes from in order to be able to start a supply chain that is no longer blind.
This is huge. The whole supply chain being no longer blind. And it does start with our responsibility to ask. I think I've been told many times, I've got patients that work at all levels in the food chain process. And I've been told that the questions we ask they change the policies in the whole system all the way along, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And especially with retailers and with restaurants, the more questions you ask, the more likely they are to open up that aperture and make sure that you have some transparency. I always find it interesting that menus will call out if they supply a local salad green. Oh, it's from this farm, these little baby romaine lettuce, or the peaches come from Dry Creek Orchard. But or the wine. Let's talk about wine. Provenance in wine has been around forever. You know where it came from, the year, you know the winery. It's all, you know, completely transparent. Same with things like oysters. Oysters are almost always named for the name of the farm. A seafood example. So what we really need is to make sure that we're supporting the ones where we know it comes from, not eliminating fish and seafood altogether. It's one of the most nutritious and abundant foods on the planet with the lowest carbon footprint. It is the food of the future. So we might as well at this point get used to the taste of kelp and seaweed, because we're going to produce more kelp and seaweed in the U.S. than potatoes by 2040. And you can return oceans to abundance, and it's zero inputs. So why not change the ocean by the way you snack, by eating a kelp chip instead of a potato chip?
Now, can you see, folks, why my daughter turned to me and said, I would follow that woman over a cliff? This is the kind of stuff that, I mean, we're ordinary running to the grocery store just trying to make, you know, chicken soup when somebody's sick, or meatloaf on Saturdays, you know? I just love the confidence and the opening up. We got to talk more about this whole thing about other seafoods that we're not thinking of that, like you said, will be normal in our food sources in very, very quickly before we know it. First, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to learn so much about this whole blue foods world and this movement and how to join it. You know how the constant negative noise in our digital lives feels like it's reaching a boiling point? Now, many of us have tuned out the news and social media almost entirely. Well, it doesn't have to be that way. There are newsworthy stories about amazing progress, innovation, leaps in human potential, and wonders in the natural world, and they're just not reaching the top of our feeds. We can have access to this, but none of us has the time or maybe even the emotional stamina to search through all the doom and gloom news to find what's right with the world. Okay, enter the Goodness Exchange. There, we are giving instant access to positive news for curious people. Did you hear about the recent Harvard study that found that exposure to just 4 minutes of good news can make you 32% less anxious and 18% more optimistic? Well, I don't know about you, but I need those kind of numbers in my life. So if you want to live with more joy and way less fear, it's really simple. First, you join us at the Goodness Exchange. Everyone around the world has the opportunity to access this kind of content. And we've promised no politics for about a decade, so you're safe from all that distraction as well. Second, you allow this new more positive, balanced worldview to put a spring in your step again. It can change the way you react to your kids, your coworkers, everybody you come in contact with. And the stories we write about can make you the idea person in your circles. These challenging times call for us to wake up and take control of our perspective. The people who use the Goodness Exchange have the ability to react to the harshness of the world much different because they know way more about what's right with the world. And that's a resource. So subscribe to the Goodness Exchange, our YouTube channel and the podcast, and use this content to live a more expansive worldview. It is still an amazing world out there, and you can be a part of it. Welcome to the Conspiracy of Goodness. Okay, we're back with aquaculture expert Jennifer Bushman. Jennifer is the co-founder of an incredible organization that we're now going to learn a little bit more about called Fed by Blue. Why it's called that, it's really a movement. Talk to us about that, this whole world of Fed by Blue.
You know, we're trying to seed this movement. It's exactly what you've stated. And there never has been a communication strategy around the importance of foods from water. Just the very fact that there have been these designations by the UN and other countries, even the importance of things like the Magnuson-Stevenson Act and the growth of aquaculture in the United States. But very rarely do you sit down when we're speaking about larger food system conversations and somebody says, let's talk about fish and seafood. Usually it's about regenerative agriculture, it's about becoming vegan or vegetarian, you know, that we can move away from animal proteins. And most of the reason why is because what's happening with animal proteins and the proteins on land and the poor rearing tactics of these. So one of the things about Fed by Blue was myself, co-founder Jill Kaufman Johnson, co-founder Catherine Breyer, was we felt that there needed to be an organization that was agnostic, that was not funded by industry, that was funded by those that were protecting the ocean, private family offices and foundations, that really stood on good science. We work with the Blue Food Assessment, which is an organization based at Stanford University, the University of Stockholm, of hundreds of scientists worldwide that are talking about, that are vetting the science, that are reading, and researching and writing the papers that all say that we can support and be supported by this food system. And we felt that it Fed by Blue, along with other partners like Andrew Zimmerman, who's an executive producer of our show, David E. Kelly, who's a renowned executive producer in Hollywood, those that had been championing Foods from Water are making this journey with us. The advisory board is made up of the Nature Conservancy, the Environmental Defense Fund, the World WWF, Alexandra Cousteau's Oceans 2050, Julia Ormond's Assets, that's making sure that the supply chain and the labor around it is getting better. So really taking all of the experts, standing on solid science and saying Fed by Blue can now begin to amplify the importance of this through the activities like the docuseries and other things that we have launching in June.
I just got goosebumps. I did not have an appreciation for how much sources, credibility, science, citations, all that is so important to everything that we've put together at the Goodness Exchange for 10 years. You know, we haven't had ads. We don't do politics. We cite our sources with my daughter's Harvard standards. And to hear you say it just like you just did, it gets me very, very inspired, because that is, isn't that the crux of what you're up against a lot, is the narratives and the lack of trust that consumers have? We don't know who to trust anymore.
That's right. I mean, what we're saying is the beginning of socializing an idea, creating change, begins with trust. And so for us, the docuseries was that foundation of trust. And that's one of the reasons why we partnered with PBS North America and PBS Learning Media, because we felt that there's so much poor media out there through streaming entities, through the internet, that we wanted to stand on the solid foundation of trust that PBS had built, tell the stories that really provide hope for what's going on the water, so that when you're at home, you are activated. You're not just a passive viewer or listener. You're going to activate and help seed this movement, even if only. Now that we've had a conversation about it, you start to ask about what can happen, what impact these foods can have, and how you can support it.
It's lovely. It's lovely. Okay. So I understand. So now you got me really fired up with the with your sourcing and your citations and all the really important people that don't have an agenda other than to have a nice shared future. Tell us about 30 by 30, because that there's a connection there that I don't think ordinary everyday people like me know about. That's super important to the really big picture on our planet.
Yes. So the docuseries, we really, and Fed by Blue, we're really focusing on three things. The first is we think that fisheries that are well managed, that are really creating coastal economies, supporting indigenous communities, and really in service to their own communities and the population at large, are well managed. And there is a voice in all of this about what the changes are that are happening on the water and how important it is that we're listening to that. Because remember, food systems are local. They're close to our heart. And honoring what that heritage and that history is very important. Number one. Number two is responsible aquaculture. So we've talked about whether it's the rearing of seaweed and bivalves or sea vegetables, things like finfish. There is a way to do it right and there's a way to do it wrong. But the ocean is 90% fish to or over capacity. So while we have well-managed fisheries in the United States, we are literally out in the world eating up the whole bowl of popcorn through bad practices, large-scale commercial fishing, and a number of other things. So our feeling is that marine protected areas are essential in supporting not only life and regeneration of the ocean environment, but also in service to a more abundant ocean, therefore a more abundant food system. And what that means is taking a space of the ocean, for example, like what President Bush, expanded by President Obama, did in the state of Hawaii, which is they designate an area which today is the largest area in the world that is protected from any human activity. So there's no fishing in it. It literally is a place. Think of it like Yellowstone National Park, where you're allowed to visit it, but you're not allowed to have impact on it at all. The fish don't know. So basically, it's the size of the state of Texas. It's this beautiful marine protected area, and the fish are able to go and spawn. The marine mammals are able to go and have a place where they can rest and where maybe they can even, if it's birthing season, they can have their babies. But there's a place where they can regenerate and replenish. And same with the ocean and the coral and the ocean beds, all of this that has an incredibly important part of our ecosystem and the ocean and the planet at large. But the fish don't know after they've had a great time and they've spawned and they've been in this marine protected area. It's not like we're putting a fence and nets up. What happens is then it creates ocean abundance all around it. In fact, in some cases, with some species of fish and seafood in the Hawaiian marine protected area, it's more than four times abundant than it's been in 150 years. So we're supporting amazing abundance for the fishermen. We're putting more food into the local food system. We have more food security for the state of Hawaii, which now imports more fish and seafood than it actually produces. So we're getting that abundance. And we can do this all over the world. 30 by 30 is to protect 30% of the ocean by 2030 so that we can return the ocean to abundance and be able to produce more food out of it and have more healthy and abundant ecosystems.
Mm. So what I hear you saying is not unlike examples on land that some of us have brushed up against. I inherited, when my dad passed away, a big farm in Illinois, and my brother has the farm next to us. And we are doing all this stuff to have wildlife flourish. Mm-hmm. Well, what I hear from all the neighbors is by all the means that and measures that we are putting in place to make wildlife flourish on that 400 acres, it's making an abundance past our borders that just goes in every direction. And that's the same in the sea, but with, what do they call it? No catch zones all over the planet?
With no take zones. In fact, we have a story that we tell in the docuseries about two men that lived in Scotland. And for 17 years, they fought to protect 1 square mile for a no-take zone because scallop dredging had decimated the bottom of the ocean floor and therefore the food column. And I'll say, for those of you that are maybe a little bit older, that they went all Braveheart in the pubs, meaning they were fighting with the fishermen, they were fighting tooth and nail to just get 1 square mile. Once this was passed and they were able to protect this area, it regenerated because when these water systems have the chance, the moment to get a rest, they actually regenerate. And now that fishery is 4 times more abundant than it has been in decades.
Wow. I love that story. That is just quintessential, I think, to so many ecosystem advances that we could be making all over the planet, land and sea. Am I right?
That's exactly right.
So we're talking scallops. We've mentioned kelp and seaweed. Like it isn't just the tuna that arrives on our table or that we buy at the store or the swordfish. Talk to us about a lot of the perimeter seafood that will be or is becoming or could be on our dinner plates in such a magical way if we all sort of improve our consumer habits and get this going.
You know, it's interesting because there's so many underutilized species, we call it, where we don't have a taste for it. Things like it's not shrimp, it's not salmon. You know, most of the egregious practices in fisheries as well as in aquaculture have happened because of scale. We begin consuming more and more and more and more of it. And it's that scale of consumption that causes the collapse of sustainable actions. And so when we look at underutilized species, this is the reality of what climate change and our consumption is going to be. Because as the waters warm, as there's more acidity in the water, there will still be fish in the sea. It's just that it's going to be different. So you're going to see things like mullet or dogfish or other species, who knows what they'll be, where the fisheries are going to move and the fishermen are going to have to catch something different. So one of the best things that you could do is have a diverse diet of seafood. Challenge yourself to try an anchovy. There's incredible tinned seafood now. One of my friends who has the fish wife has the most amazing tinned anchovies. It's all about, is it sustainably caught? What is the region and provenance? How is it tinned so that it doesn't get all fishy, where you end up with something that's lovely that you can put over toast with butter? And you might not have ever liked to have an anchovy before because you were used to kind of that stinky, yucky anchovy that now is not the next generation's fish and seafood. In fact, on TikTok, tinned seafood has gotten billions of impressions. Billions. And you think about it, it's an amazing opportunity because it doesn't go bad. It sits in your cupboard for a long time. There are many, many different types. And you can use a little bit of it because it's stronger in flavor. So it can be sprinkled over pasta or over a pizza. And it's just a delicious way to be able to enjoy fish and seafood, but maybe a little less is more. And also trying new things.
So I think, did you come to this topic from sort of an expertise in how to set up your pantry around having seafood staples? Share some of that with us.
Yes. I mean, my background for many, many years, I was a cooking teacher. I did a television show and a series, sort of in the days when people weren't cooking at home. You know, 20 years ago, when none of my friends were cooking for their kids, it was all kind of dump and do, I used to call it. And my career evolved. What I said was I've had two fish in my life that I've fallen in love with. One was the rainbow trout that my grandfather used to catch off the rivers of Colorado near his ranch. And then the other one was a farm salmon from a third generation family farmer. And so I realized and recognized that I wanted fish and seafood to be more available. And part of the problem is we usually think of it as like fresh seafood's best, which means I have to think about either buying it at the grocery store, coming home and cooking it, or I've got to eat it out. So instead, what I did was I came up with ideas. They're available on jenniferbushman.com, where CSEA pantry is really about things that you can keep on hand. What are those responsible choices that you can make where you've got seafood in the freezer, you've got smoked seafood that's that delicious smoked trout or smoked salmon that's in the refrigerator, and then you've got a bounty of things like canned clams to make a quick chowder with, or a tinned seafood that's a delicious trout, or whatever that's just waiting for you to enjoy.
Right. Well, that is it. You know, there's a lot of things around eating fish that we think that we've just got to buy it fresh that day. And that we, and I probably as many as anybody would put it off because I can't even plan tomorrow night. Will my husband be home? Will I need to feed eight or two of us? You know, all that sort of stuff. So we just kind of go buy it then. But you're talking about stuff I see now that is, it can be in the pantry, like the smoked fish or the tell me stuff that goes good in that lasts well in the freezer.
In the freezer, the firmer fish, so the more delicate fish, sort of the theory is that because fish is primarily water, and it does that water does expand when it's frozen and contracts, it can be a little bit lesser quality. But what I will tell everybody is that frozen is the new fresh, and the freezing techniques where it immediately gets frozen at 60 degrees below zero, where it gets vacuum sealed. There are many, many fish that are delicious to eat frozen. Halibut, tuna. I could go on and on. I would say the most delicate of the fish, like sole, that's very delicate and flaky, is less delicious frozen. Gets a little mushy, a little grainier. But the firmer fish, those are absolutely fantastic. And, you know, listen, you can walk into a Whole Foods, buy a bag of portions of salmon, all sustainably raised in beautiful farms. There are only three farms in the world that qualify to sell salmon to Whole Foods, only three farmers. But that fish is delicious, frozen in portion packs. And then you come home, you put it in a little bit of tepid water, it thaws. You can skillet it and, you know, really just brown it and throw it in the oven or broil it or grill it. And you have a quick instant meal.
All right. I'm headed there tomorrow. I'm already hungry like I thought. Okay. So talk to us about, I just want to drill down because this is really important. You have that great little saying about it's kind of crazy to expect things to be wild caught, because that's actually where the damage is happening. It just doesn't need to be that way anymore. So talk to us about the advancements, the ingenuity, and why we shouldn't be after wild caught. We wouldn't ask that for a hamburger, you know, like talk to us about that whole world.
Yeah, isn't it funny that we have this consumptive entitlement to wild resources of seafood, but everything else that we eat is farmed? And I don't know where that came from, but it certainly is something that's causing a lot of problems for whales that still need to be able to eat wild salmon, or for marine mammals or birds that still need anchovies and herring and mackerel to be able to survive. So we begin there, which is that we really need to figure out a way to farm this seafood well. And just like how any food system has gone awry, we think about corn and tomatoes and GMOs that really came out of the need for food security in the 1970s. And then, listen, aquaculture was the same way. It scaled, and all of a sudden we were getting tilapia from poopy waters in Asia. We were getting very poorly reared salmon and all kinds of other shrimp, as you mentioned, and all kinds of other seafood. But the pendulum now is swinging back. And this is probably one of the most technologically advanced food systems that we have. And yet what we have is the opportunity to be able to make it what we want it to be, because it is still relatively new and growing. So when we look at it, things like Google has a company called Title X that is AI technology that can actually look into a fish farm and be able to see per individual fish, how it is growing, how it is being raised. Are there any issues with it? Does it have any wounds, or is it not growing the way that it should? It can actually, this system, measure the water, temperatures, pH levels, algae levels. So we're starting to put technologies like this onto the farms in order to be able to collect data, do amazing work to understand what is happening in real time in order to make sure that we have the best animal husband rearing practices as possible. And so this is all here in front of us. And there are farmers all over the world that are working on these practices, working on feed models. And it's really only a matter of time until you see those techniques at scale. Right now, it is possible. You just have to look for the farmer. You have to demand when you're in the store and looking at a menu that you want that farmer name on the menu. Because this does not work if the supply chain is blind. And we've been at this for so long without demanding that the farmer or the background on the fish and seafood doesn't show up anywhere, that it's going to take a lot to push that boulder up and over the top of the mountain in order to get the momentum we need to have provenance from our fish and seafood.
How do we get here? Because, you know, I read the packages. If I'm getting, I try and get ground beef locally from a local farmer that's my patient. But when I can't and I'm at the grocery store, I read the labels to see where it's from. I don't want ground beef from a giant feedlot where I think 3,000 pounds of meat go into a hopper from like 70 different cows. I don't want that. And so why are we accepting it from our seafood? Is it just a matter of consumers just getting on board and demanding this and sharing it with others? Because it's a pretty simple ask.
I think it's like cage-free eggs. We never knew that chicken were in cages and that they looked the way that they did. And then all of a sudden on the internet, this huge movement started. And now Walmart even will have cage-free eggs in the next 5 years. So I do believe in the power of the people. That's why we founded Fed by Blue. That's why we want you to watch the docuseries and activate if there's something that's interesting. That's why we want you to be an active contributor to this. I mean, Alexandre Cousteau says that we no longer should be looked at as consumers. No one wants to be thought of as someone consuming a planet that has been over-consumed. I don't want to be measured by how much I consume. That the way we change this behavior is that we all want to believe and we want to know in our hearts that our dollars and our actions are in contribution to something bigger than ourselves. So what I would say is, don't look at me as a consumer. Look at me as a contributor. I am in contribution to supporting fishermen that are doing the right work, farmers that are doing the right work on land and sea, providing wonderful options where foods can feel like they're abundant, even at a time when a lot around us is scary, that we can see the moments. I want my nieces to eat seaweed and kelps in the same way that they enjoyed French fries. And if we don't start now, then our children are going to look back at the age of 10 when they had their birthday party and go, wow, that was the best meal I ever had.
This is it. You've given me goosebumps again. You've nailed it. That Alexandre Cousteau passage is something we've really got to think of. The difference between being consumers and contributors on a planet that we already know is being drained mercilessly. Wow.
Right.
It's something I'm going to think of over and over again. Thanks for sharing that with us.
It's very moving. And we can do that every single day through the choices that we make. It doesn't mean that you have to be able to afford something that's organic and dot, 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 dot. What you have to be is an active contributor in the way that you look at the world. And if you're doing these things, even dinner can be in contribution to something that's bigger than yourself.
That's magical. That is such a great, simple statement. Okay, so let's do that. Snack time. Let's do something practical here for a minute. Maybe snack time. Can snack time be something in service to the greater good right now? Are there already starting to be startups and folks who are creating food snacks?
Yes, I mean, 12 Tides chips are one of my favorites, and they're pieces of puffed kelp. And they're getting these from incredible farms that are both in the U.S. and Mexico. What people don't know is water farmers, aquaculture, the largest crop that's grown in the world is seaweed and kelp. And the majority of those farmers are women. So supporting these farms is also a way in which you can support women. And most of our seaweed in the United States is imported right now. So really think about, bring those 12 Tides chips in, serve them with that guacamole, if that's what you like with your chips, and start to shift and learn, a palate has to be built. We've trained our palates over the generations for so long, whether it's for sugar, whether it's for fat, whether it's away from flavors, at brighter flavors and stronger flavors and into more mild ones. And we have to start raising a generation that's used to these foods. And one of the foods that it will be the most important is going to be seaweed. And so 12 Tides kelp chips.
You are just full of some quotes that are going to stick in my mind. A palate has to be built. That is at the bottom line here, right? Like, there's going to be some people listening to this who are saying, oh, I couldn't eat seaweed for a snack. But that's just because it's not what your average person in Indiana ever did. But if it was just part of our life, like, there's plenty of people on this planet that would look at a Cheeto and say, I'm not putting that fluorescent orange thing in my mouth for any amount of money in the world, right? It's just what you know. When my kids were growing up, I'm a dentist. My husband and I are both dentists. And as we were growing up, of course, we don't have soda in our house. It would never occur to me to buy soda. And yet so many of my kids' friends and such expected soda with dinner. Well, we were an all milk with dinner crowd. And so we taught our first daughter and the other kids too, but that soda was sparkling water, just plain unflavored sparkling water. So we remember the first night she went to our neighbor's house to have dinner. She was about 4 and she came home and she was bouncing off the walls at 11 o'clock at night. And we said, oh, Liesl, what did you have for dinner tonight at the neighbor's? And she goes, Mom, they had black soda. And she recognized instantly that she was bouncing off the walls because of this black colored soda. Ow. Well, of course it was Coca-Cola or Pepsi.
Right.
And I mean, when you're talking about how we have to start this early and just start contributing as consumers with things at the level of childhood, that is the way we change the world in almost every aspect, right? It always starts with a generation.
It does. And that's why for us with Hope in the Water, that on PBS, it was so important because PBS is giving this content edited for kids and there'll be toolkits for teachers to 90% of schools in North America by August. So for us, we need kids like saying, wow, you know what? I learned about this seaweed farmer and I want to try seaweed. Children will eat 90% of the foods they participate in making. Children will eat 90% of the foods they participate in making. So you've got to bring these foods in. They've got to taste them, try them, be a part of the process. And by the way, it takes kids about 7 times on average of them trying a new food to eat it, get used to it, and like it. And I think you probably know some adults that are just like this because adults are often more finicky eaters than children, and they mimic what their dads eat. So for all the dads out there, or if you are a male in a household that has influence to children, it really starts to land on you to be a responsible eater, to eat openly and with the wisdom of the kind of ingredients that will have impact for the planet and what future eating looks like. You know, really the future is now. I mean, this is all in front of us with the crops and the way things are changing. This is all happening now. Within the next 5 to 10 years, the shape of the foods that we'll have available that can be bought at a reasonable price are going to look very different than they do today. So why not start now?
Okay. Anything else you want to talk to us about getting excited about this documentary? Because I literally can't wait, and we will do whatever we can to promote it. We're big PBS fans. Our kids were raised on PBS, and they're different humans as adults now because of the way they grew up. Same same rationale back to what you know when you're little. So talk to us anything more about the documentary you want to get us fired up about?
So it's three parts. It's airing on starting on June 19th. It's national PBS, so it will be on Wednesday, the 19th, starting for 3 weeks in a row, June 26th and July 2nd. Everyone will have it in the United States and North America. It is called Hope in the Water. It's executive produced by Andrew Zimmern and David E. Kelly, and it stars Jose Andres, Martha Stewart, Baratunde Thurston, Shailene Woodley. And they're really there to show you to witness the work that's on the water and to show you these incredible people that are doing amazing work, all in service to an abundant food system from water. So I encourage everybody to watch it. You'll be able to go to fedbyblue.org and learn more about how to support and be able to purchase through our Seafood Scout, Responsible Seafood. And then in March of 2025, Blue Foods Hope in the Water by Andrew Zimmern and Barton Seaver is coming out from HarperCollins Harvest. So there'll be a 400-page cookbook that's got recipes, sidebars, stories, and background all about foods from water, all under the title Hope in the Water.
Oh, I just got my Christmas present, my birthday present. When did you say that book is coming out?
March of 2025. It'll be published. Great. And again, Andrew Zimmern and Barton Seaver are writing it. And then renowned photographer Eric Wolfinger is doing the photography.
Fabulous. Fabulous. Okay. So let's go out with a few practical tips. I don't even know how to ask this question now after how you've informed me. Are there foods that they're just so far no sustainable way to come up with them besides the giant fishing trawlers just sucking in everything and casting stuff? Like, are there foods that we absolutely should stay away from for now until we can figure out how to farm them?
Well, we're not going to farm every species. So again, this sushi board, so to speak, is going to be filled with maybe a little tiny bit of wild seafood and a little bit more of aquaculture and maybe even one that's plant-based, right? It's going to have all different inputs. I would say that the one that we're having the most trouble farming because of its behaviors, because it's based on a lunar calendar, because it doesn't have specific spawning areas that we understand, is tuna. And so just make sure that, like, where you are, there are some abundant bluefin tuna fisheries. Make sure that you know what fisherman is bringing it in. Bluefin is one of those that has been overfished in the past. So it's just being aware, going to purveyors that you trust, being aware of where these things come from. You know, one of the probably the worst things, not so much coming from where you are, but is on the menu all the time, is calamari. And most of the time, that squid comes from unsustainable fisheries. But in the Northeast, you have a very abundant Marine Stewardship Council, MSC, certified fishery, and there's town dock squid that, as long as you're going to a restaurant and you ask them where that came from before you eat the calamari, you're probably perfectly fine. But when you go to a restaurant where you don't know, the odds are it could come from fisheries outside of the U.S. and be unsustainably caught. And that's where we start to get into trouble. So again, I'll go back to ask.
All right. That is something we order almost all the time at this seafood restaurant. So just to be really clear, and just so that everybody listening can translate it to wherever they live, because this podcast is listened to all over the world. You go in and you say, I'd love to order that seafood, that calamari on the menu, but I'd love to know where it's from. And I am expecting that most of us would have a hard time asking that, because the look we're going to get back is, you know, blink, 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 but we ask it anyway.
You ask it anyway. You see what they have as an answer. And honestly, some short, you've got your phone probably with you, and all you would need to do, if you knew the species and the country of origin, is whether it's the certification bodies or whether it's a fisherman, if they say it's close to where you are, the information is going to come up, and then you can make a choice not to order it or to order it. You know, there are some safe things like bivalves, mussels, that beautiful mussels and frites that are on every menu, oysters. There are lots and lots of sort of, you can always order it. It's a safe choice. But when it comes to the wild-caught finfish and the farmed finfish, this is one where you're going to want to dig in a little bit deeper.
Okay. And I'm assuming you've got some links that you can share with us that we can put in our show notes.
Yes.
So that people can get somewhere quickly and maybe...
That's correct. And then watch when the cookbook comes out, because there's going to be an app called Seafood Scout that comes out with the book, and you'll be able to type in and then you'll get the like Yelp for seafood. You'll learn where in your area you can actually get sustainable seafood and get some information about the fishermen and the farmers and things as well. So we're excited to be working on that right now and have it come out in March.
Wow, that's perfect. That's exactly what, kind of how I was going to wrap up was if there until then, is there any apps that you recommend, or is there some place that we can instantly have a touch that helps
there,
us?
There are a number of them, and we'll make a list of them. The Aquaculture Stewardship Council, Marine Stewardship Council, you know, nobody does, there is no one size fits all. And not every NGO, especially in certifications, does everything right. But what I say is there are three parts of the market: floaters, swimmers, and divers. And if you're a floater and you just want to eat responsible seafood and you don't want to have to think about it, then things like the bivalves or going to a restaurant where you trust the chef or walking into a local store where you trust that they have a good seafood policy is the answer for you. So you don't have to think about it. If you're a swimmer, and a lot of us are, where we want a little bit of information, but we don't want to learn everything about it, we just want to know where the calamari comes from, well, then you can maybe look up those couple of fisheries and be the squid expert, because that's what you like to order. And then if you're a diver and you dive in and you learn every single thing about a topic, then go to things like the Aquaculture Stewardship Council, Marine Stewardship Council. Look at what NOAA's doing around sustainable seafood. Come to fedbyblue.org. Open up that aperture and really look to see where it's coming from and what the background is. What are the certification numbers? Were they on the boxes? You know, there are all kinds of things that are helping us create the tools to have a path to sustainable, responsible sourced blue foods.
Wow. Okay. That's great. You know what? I'm going to become that. I'll put my research. I'm a really good researcher because of the way we've tried to cite our sources so careful. And I will become the diver in the calamari world. And I'll make sure that is in the show notes. And I would like to wrap up with one last question, but remind people that when you find this episode on Spotify or Apple Tunes or wherever you get your podcasts, it's going to have a brief description, but we're going to have so much more. There'll be an actual article built with all kinds of links on the Goodness Exchange website for the Conspiracy of Goodness podcast. So if you go there, you're going to really appreciate the fullness of Jennifer's message. So my last question is something I ask everybody. You know, this interview had only been 3 minutes long. I know when I published my book, I got 3 minutes, you know, on this station and 3 minutes on that station. If this had only been 3 minutes long, What do you really wish people knew?
How important these foods were. How many people rely on them. It's that simple. We eat only 17 and a half pounds, one of the lowest per capita amounts of fish and seafood in the industrialized world. But around the world, we rely on them. And it's so important. I want you to think about the fact that those waters are still available. Our waters have acted as the largest food bank since the beginning of time. In areas across the world and even in your own backyard, you still have the ability to fish for your dinner. Let's align protection with production. Let's find more modern ways of looking at this. And let's recognize how important they are so that we can have a responsible blue food system in the future.
Lovely. Thank you so much, Jennifer Bushman. This has been an eye-opener. I can't wait to June 19th. I hope everyone will put that on their calendar. I'm sure it'll come your way because the little research I did, the trailer and so forth, it's going to be a magnificent 3 episodes. And I know that we all will make this weird giant leap into a new, more positive future full of possibility we never even realized. Okay, so I hope that you will join us again next week, but thank you, Jennifer, for sharing all this. I hope our audience will get a spring in their step from some of this and enjoy the same kind of wonder and so forth that Jennifer and I have been sharing for the last hour. Jennifer, thank you.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Okay. See you next week, folks.